The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Over in books, Oprah announces The Tell as her latest book club pick. Oprah was floored by this extraordinary memoir about repressed childhood trauma and psychedelic-assisted breakthroughs. This article is by Charlie Burlock. Today, on CBS Mornings, Oprah announced that her March book club pick is, drumroll please, The Tell by Amy Griffin, an earth-shattering memoir about one woman's quest to uncover repressed childhood trauma, overcome perfectionism, and live a life of authentic joy. From the outside, Amy Griffin's life looked perfect. She was the powerhouse founder of the investment firm G9 Ventures, the mother of four beautiful children, wife to an adoring husband, and somehow still had the energy for punishingly long daily runs in Central Park. But there was something Amy was running from, something she had kept hidden from everyone in her life, including herself. With the help of psychedelic-assisted therapy, she opened the door to the darkest recesses of her memory and the brightest version of her future. "I was just floored when I read Amy's story," said Oprah. What she discovered about herself, her past, made me recognize how powerful the desire to forget is, and also how powerful the desire to remember is, and how your life can change when you reconcile the two. "I've spent the last 5 years writing, drafting, and considering every word I wanted to share about my experience," said Griffin. "When Oprah called, I forgot every one of those words. All I know is that I was in my closet thinking, is this really happening?" The Tell is the latest selection in Oprah's ongoing collaboration with Starbucks. The partnership offers the same must-read book club recommendations from Oprah, along with newly formatted author interviews and official Starbucks beverage pairings for each monthly pick. Oprah sat down with Griffin and a live audience at the Starbucks Chicago Roastery to discuss the memoir's themes of recovery, reconciliation, and reinvention. The full conversation is available for free on Oprah's YouTube channel. You can also listen to it on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok for more book club content and conversations. We're excited to hear what you think of the transformational memoir. So the book that accompanies this article is The Tell by Amy Griffin, and right now it's $20 at Amazon. Over in wellness, we have, "Is This Why You're So Tired?" A condition that's often missed and affects more than a third of women under 50 might explain things. This article is by The Editors. How often are you not just tired, but brain dead? Bone weary, please don't ask me to move exhausted. Except your doctor says everything looks good because your thyroid, hemoglobin, blood pressure, and cholesterol tests all come back normal. That kind of tired is not normal, says Angela Weyand, MD, a pediatric hematologist and associate professor at the University of Michigan. One of Weyand's clinical interests is in iron deficiency, the symptoms of which include extreme fatigue, weakness, headache, lightheadedness, cold hands and feet, and unusual cravings, among others. Sound familiar? you have lots of company. In July 2023, Weyand and her team released a study that found the overall prevalence of iron deficiency was about 40% in young menstruating individuals. Iron is the most common nutrient deficiency in the world, but it does tend to affect menstruating people more frequently, says Weyand. Men, for the most part, take in and hold on to enough iron. But if you're bleeding monthly, that's one route to iron deficiency. Recent shifts in women's reproductive timelines play a role, too. We have earlier onset of periods, says Weyand, a later age of menopause, and fewer pregnancies. So, individuals are spending a greater portion of their lives losing blood than before. That's a problem, because iron is a critical element in the production of red blood cells, and extreme iron deficiency presents as anemia. People are most at risk for iron deficiency and iron deficiency anemia during growth stages like early childhood, adolescence, and pregnancy. But Weyand has seen many teen and adult patients struggle mightily with symptoms their referring physician hasn't realized were probably due to a less extreme iron deficiency. That's partly because the symptoms are nonspecific and could signal other issues. It's also due to how physicians typically screen for iron deficiency. Historically, a hemoglobin test is ordered, which does not measure iron, but does tell you if someone is anemic. Iron deficiency is just one of many possible causes of anemia, and even though it's the most common cause, many patients with iron deficiency are missed by focusing on hemoglobin alone. Also, more recent research suggests that one's ferritin level might be a better indicator. Ferritin, that's spelled F-E-R-R-I-T-I-N, shows how much iron is stored in the body. Problem is, there's no consensus around what normal is. The World Health Organization sets its healthy range from 15 to 150 UG/1, but the lower limit varies significantly between labs and institutions, and in some instances drops into the single digits. Weyand also notes that these intervals are based on the levels of healthy women volunteers, but a lot of these healthy women are iron deficient themselves. This frustration is one reason Weyand has become an advocate for getting people tested. Check her out on X, formerly Twitter, at A-C-W-E-Y-A-N-D. She's also working to change the diagnostic standard for iron deficiency, in large part because the condition doesn't just cause crazy exhaustion. There's data on iron deficiency and restless leg syndrome, a condition women are more prone to, says Weyand. Also, a lot of people are now talking about iron in your brain because it's a known factor for making things like serotonin and dopamine, which are involved with mood. I am not saying that everyone who has depression just needs iron, but there is probably a subset of patients that, if we corrected their iron, wouldn't even need other things. Another aspect concerns menopausal women. Conventional wisdom suggests that they don't lose iron because they no longer have periods. But as Weyand points out, if their ferritin levels have been at 11 or 12 or 15 UG/1, their whole lives and remain so, then they're still going to be walking around wrung out, freezing, lightheaded, and possibly drawn to chewing ice, one of those unusual cravings. Some people crave chalk and even dirt, and a potential sign of iron deficiency. Technically, these women are normal, and in menopause, physicians would likely be more concerned if patients had too much iron, because an excess is toxic, or internal bleeding. Low iron levels can be a sign of colon cancer. Don't get me wrong, says Weyand, people need screening for colon cancer. But for those who've had these symptoms, it might be worth having a conversation with your doctor and testing your ferritin levels, something Weyand says is not often done. The situation is changing, however. In 2023, the International Federation of Gynecological and Obstetrics announced that women should be regularly tested for iron deficiency throughout their lives. There's also ongoing research to change the recommended minimum levels of ferritin, which would encourage treatment. That will take time, as some patients say they feel fine at 15 UG/1 and others are a train wreck unless it's over 50 UG/1. Still, the good news is that iron deficiency is treatable. Doctors may recommend an over-the-counter iron supplement. For patients who experience gastrointestinal issues like constipation or diarrhea, a common side effect of oral iron, they may suggest a prescription that takes that into account. Weyin also prescribes iron via IV, which can wipe out a deficit in some individuals, and using certain formulations in one fell swoop. She says this is the best route if doctors have identified and addressed the underlying issue, whether that's heavy periods, a missing element in diet, or other issue, otherwise the deficiency will recur. Another reason it's important to talk to your doctor before taking supplements. In the U.S., about 1 in 300 non-Hispanic white people are carriers of a rogue gene that causes a condition called hereditary hemochromatosis, aka iron overload disorder. The rates are lower in other races and ethnicities. Some of the symptoms can be similar to someone suffering from low iron, but the long-term health consequences are serious. A blood test will determine if you're one of the more than 1 million Americans affected. Weyin sees a lot of adolescent patients who thought their exhaustion was due to high-pressure high school. They had no idea they didn't need to be that tired. She's also heard from adults on social media who message her saying, "It's weird that I go into the doctor and say, 'Well, I follow this hematologist on Twitter,' but when they get the treatment they need, they DM back, 'I feel like a new person.'" Staying in wellness, extreme stress can trigger early menopause. One woman reflects on the family crisis that rocked her world and her body to the core. This article is by Kira von Eichel. "I know a woman whose family fled the Soviet Union in 1985 when she was 7. At the train station just before the border, her mother was taken into custody by Soviet guards. In the 24 hours they held her mother, a circle of hair from the child's scalp simply fell out. Her mother was released. They made it to Italy, and by the time they had settled in Baltimore, her hair had grown back. The story always stayed with me. What the fear of losing her mother will do to the child's body in a matter of hours. In my case, it was the inverse. I was in my early 40s when, out of the blue, we had a very sick child. I didn't lose my hair all at once, but my body changed, almost overnight. We went from being a normal enough family to one in a constant state of crisis. I spent hours every day filling out forms in waiting rooms, arguing with arrogant doctors and insurance companies, pleading with kindly ones, alternating all-night vigils with my husband. I became a desperate comber of articles, medical papers, and blogs. I arranged meetings with friends of friends who might have a lead, anything to grab hold of some invisible steering wheel that would give us the illusion of control. My husband and I were like harried army medics, and as nothing upon nothing worked, the wonderful us we had been just faded into two exhausted housemates who happened to share children. Mounting terror and disagreement slowly calcified into resentment. I tried to keep dates with friends, and if I made it to the appointed place at the appointed time, I tried not to cry, and often failed. The best people stuck around, but many others fell away. I was also still trying to keep our other child's life humming. School events, volleyball tournaments, birthday parties, appointments, mother-daughter dates. In theory, I was a machine and killing it. And looking back with empathy for that woman in her early 40s, I do see a fierce warrior queen who swam people to shore with one arm tied behind her back. The gift of motherhood is that you believe you can actually lift a car if needed. Even with life sliding quickly from a recognizable path, you tell yourself you will find a solution and you will fix everything for everyone. But something always gives. This time, it was my body that gave. In spite of a pretty healthy lifestyle, I gained 25 pounds. Parts of my body I'd never thought could expand seemed almost cartoonish as they bulged and stretched. Like puberty on fast forward, if you added another set of breasts on top of the ones already there. A once thick mane of hair was now diminished, collecting around the shower drain, seemingly by the handful with each washing. Every morning, I awoke to the imprint of a sweat-drenched body on my sheets, like a chalk outline of a formerly functioning self. At the cocktail parties I dragged myself to maintain some semblance of a social life, even as I knew an emergency call would drag me home minutes after arriving. I flushed hot as the earth's iron core from the inside out with the first glass of red wine. Or if conversation got awkward, "Is it hot in here?" I wondered aloud as I peeled off as many layers as I politely could mid-party. Everything was bone on bone. Noises. People. Even worse, a once wonderful, fun, close, and happy sex life disappeared. I had always loved men, and most especially the one I'd chosen. Suddenly, I was meh. And so we moved further apart still. "It must be stress," I thought. A smart friend wasn't buying it and recommended I get checked for an autoimmune condition or a thyroid issue. After 18 tubes of blood were processed, the answer came back that I was, by the numbers, menopausal. "But I haven't even experienced perimenopause," I said, somewhat dazed. "When was my last period?" "I didn't remember. Too busy." "When did your mother experience it?" "Later." "Usually it tracks," the doctor said. She asked me if there was anything unusual going on. She had a kind, concerned look on her face. I told her the same way I told everyone then. A litany of sad details repeated so often to doctors and specialists that it sounded like a school prayer or a mantra, a series of lines that had come to define us. She nodded as she kept steady eye contact and told me that extreme stress can accelerate menopause. I thought my friend who'd lost her hair when she thought she'd lost her mother. Was my body so on the nose, such a cliché, that any threat to its offspring would flip my reproductive kill switch? I came home stunned and a little relieved. After languishing in the soupy, hellish limbo of no real answers or solutions in every other aspect of life, this was, at least, tangible. And by now, I was an expert, PhD-level researcher. I was going to slay menopause, at least. I told my husband, almost as an afterthought, what a sort of get-a-load-of-this-style bewilderment. He barely registered it. "Huh, funny," and on to putting out the next fire. That night, it occurred to me that this was the end of something, and that I had no clue what the other thing after the something was going to be. For about 3 days, I fixated on this shift in identity. Who was I without my period? Would I still be attractive, sexy, juicy? Was it something to be grieved? All the physical discomfort aside, something felt like it was being wrested from me against my will. The end of fertility felt like the end of me, or of some secret, special vibrancy accorded me by the slightly miraculous alchemy my body performed each month. The Dylan line comes to mind, "Ah, but I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now." God, I was earnest and misguided, and I took the idea of fertility so seriously, even though I was finished with having kids. In a way, the ongoing high-stakes juggling act I was engaged in was helpful. I would say that I mourned my ED fixé of my fruitfulness and sexiness for about a minute. I was aware of the thought, and then life just needed me to move on, fast. I did have to deal with the very real symptoms. On top of the body going wonky, I found myself standing in front of my desk at the bottom of the stairs in my child's room, rooted in place, wondering what I was doing there. Had I filled out this form, returned the call, picked up food? It was like trying to grasp at mist. On the other end of the spectrum, things like the wrong non-organic milk made me want to stuff my fist in my mouth and scream into the void. The extremes were unbearable bedfellows. They were disruptive and not helping me be the person I needed to be. A true child of the 1970s, I researched and tried every tea and herb and modality out there. Nothing helped enough. I learned Vedic meditation. That helped with a lot of other things. Thank you, Robert Hammond. I ate only the good, nutritious things. I did yoga. Thank you, Kula Yoga. But I was still trying to function with what felt like giant ballasts pulling me below the waterline after each attempt to clear it. And the messaging from the profit-generating world of how to be a better woman was telegraphing that if I only did more, ate less, purchased more powders and creams, I would be in control of my destiny. Finally, after much research about the misleading Women's Health Initiative study from 2002 that scared a generation of women off hormone replacement therapy and consultation with my doctor, I started bioidentical hormone replacement therapy. The best way to describe what happened once that kicked in is that you could throw a refrigerator at me and I would catch it, no sweat. Maybe even while holding an inexpert but informed conversation about nuclear fission on the side. Eventually, I switched to regular hormone replacement therapy. My executive function skills are just too lacking for the bioidentical rigmarole. There was some thinking that we might stimulate my system enough to get it all back. It never did come back. But here's the funny thing. Now at 50 and watching all my close friends get thrown into the spin cycle, what a gift! A release. A deliverance, too. I love being done. I love the benefits of being postmenopausal. Beyond the freedom from the monthly peace, other things happened. I got calmer, stronger, wiser, less risable. My perspective on people, things, life got longer and kinder. More important than anything at all, our kid got better. I know to be grateful for it every single minute of every day. My husband came closer again. We decided to ditch the alienated housemate thing and remember that we fell in love way back in the early 1990s for some excellent reasons. I'm grateful for that, too. I missed him. The desire came back, more intentional and sweet in the passion. I also learned that most people are only there for the good times, and they disappear fast in the bad. Sounds like a terrible and awfully disappointing lesson. Ultimately, it wasn't. It makes you absolutely cherish the ones who stick around even when you're faltering and breaking. You end up feeling very rich in human kindness and generosity. Grateful. It's a pretty my cup runneth over feeling. I didn't stop existing when I went through menopause unexpectedly, early. It's like I got to walk through a secret door. I'm still a woman. I'm still sexual. But a lot of the noise is gone. I'm less distracted. By now, it's a worn cliche, but you really do care less about what other people think. There's a contentment that grows deeper roots. It isn't a giving up or settling for less, per se. It's an even wilder thing. It opens up whole worlds you'd otherwise never have noticed. Sometimes, when I'm feeling particularly grateful for all this change wrought, that old Maybe It's Maybelline ad runs through my head, and I picture myself and my brilliant, wise, funny friends looking resplendently our age, gallivanting across the city street, and I replace the tagline with, Maybe It's Menopause. We're over in Work and Money. Lucinda Scala Quinn is mad hungry. How the cookbook author and entrepreneur built her business. This article is by Sophia Lodato. Lucinda Scala Quinn is a chef, cookbook author, media personality, and creator of the brand Mad Hungry, which shares recipes and tools for real daily home cooking. As the former executive food director of Martha Stewart Living, she has shaped how millions of people cook at home, emphasizing the importance of simple and satisfying meals. Mad Hungry is dedicated to teaching people how to cook smarter, eat better, and bring families together around the table. The beginnings. Even before I started working for Martha, I was a cookbook author. Concurrently, though, I was a mother with a growing family living in New York City. By the time I had my second son in our little apartment, I realized that the need for constant meals was not just a financial imperative, but was crucial for health and wellness. I wholeheartedly embraced all the details and efforts that it took to get breakfast, lunch, and dinner on the table. We published Mad Hungry Feeding Men and Boys in 2009, and it hit the zeitgeist. It was the middle of the financial recession, so tons of people were losing their jobs and were suddenly having to become at-home cooks. And it helped that the book really leaned into leftovers and frugal cooking. It rapidly became a bestseller, and before I knew it, I was getting television offers from people. The rise of the spurtle. Cut to a few years later, we had a television show, Mad Hungry with Lucinda Scala Quinn, and we were receiving a lot of fan letters. Apparently, I was always reaching for one particular tool on the air. It's something I found from a woodcarver called a spurtle, which was originally used in the 16th century to stir oatmeal. I called up the carver and asked to share his website with our viewers. About a year later, he wrote to me and said, "You've saved my business, but I just can't carve any faster." So, we built our business off the spurtle. We developed the regular wood ones, then made S-slotted and skinny spurtles, and even spurtulas, which is like a spatula. We tested with bamboo, antique, and acacia wood, and eventually made silicone ones. It was this funny evolution. It just caught on. All the tools on our site are multi-purpose, like the spurtle. Again, I come from a New York kitchen, so I don't have a lot of space. And even if I did, I don't really have use for specialty tools. By now, we've expanded. We have a Mad mixer and an all-in-one immersion blender. We have ceramics, we have bowls, we have everything cutlery. The hardest part. As I began to have more success in the 2010s, there was a lot of jealousy, and it meant that I was on my own. I loved my job at Martha, but I just couldn't keep up. I was taking days off to go to shows to do television segments. I resigned in 2015 and fortunately left on a very positive note. But it was tough because suddenly I forfeited a salary. There are also a lot of preconceived notions about the way you're supposed to age, what you can do, and when you can do things. I kept thinking, you're too old to start a business on your own. But I was lucky. I had a bunch of friends and a mentor who were all so supportive of me. A lot of women of my generation and older didn't lift other women up as much as we would have liked to. So it's a mission of mine when I see someone who's doing work with authenticity and intention to do whatever I can to lend support, because I didn't have that. A real family business. By December of 2016, my oldest son had left his job to join me. We have a very complementary skill set. He brought so much to the party that I didn't bring. He scrupulously honest and fiscally conservative, but still a risk taker. I've learned so much from him and also from his generation, which is social media oriented. I have a bit of envy for it. There's no top-down editorial authority on the internet, so you can post on social media and have much more creativity, autonomy than I ever did working in the industry. From an entrepreneurial standpoint, when we started to get some success, there was a lot of temptation to get an office hire and to grow as much as possible. But we wanted to be scrappy. We wanted to do it ourselves. Turned out to be a good thing, especially when the pandemic hit, because we could tighten up and didn't overextend ourselves in the years before. Looking ahead. Looking ahead, I'm very excited about my new book, Mother Sauce. I'm hoping to launch that into a brand as well. Exciting content leads and merchandise follows, so I will be doubling down on writing and creating content. My son is starting to pick up more of the front-facing stuff as I'm deciding whether to step back a little. It's a constantly changing dynamic, and the only thing that stays the same is the issue of change and embracing that change. Things will always change, right? And finding that middle path has been the greatest gift of my life. So the book that accompanies this article is Mother Sauce by Lucinda Scala Quinn, and it's $27 right now at Amazon. We're over in Lifestyle, Women Who Start Things. Leveling the Publishing Playing Field. Tech founder Tamira Chapman's work with Michelle Obama inspired her to start her own imprint aimed at elevating Black stories. This article is by Charlie Burlock. Tamira Chapman is a publishing outsider, and she sees that as her secret weapon to get other outsiders published. Her new imprint, Storehouse Voices, aims to celebrate the power of Black storytelling and ensure diverse voices are heard across the literary world. Before launching the imprint last month with Penguin Random House, the nation's biggest publisher, Chapman had never worked with books. She was a tech entrepreneur, a wildly successful one. In 2022, her global merchandising company, Storehouse in a Box, was ranked the 8th fastest woman-owned business in the world. So how did this founder hop from the peak of the notoriously white male landscape of tech entrepreneurship to the arguably even whiter summit of the book publishing world? She has Michelle Obama to thank in part for helping to draw a bridge. When she heard that the former First Lady was becoming a published author, Chapman put two and two together and reached out to Penguin Random House to collaborate on the rollout first of Becoming and later of The Light We Carry. Leveraging the big, powerful audiences she collected, serving a number of major nonprofits, she organized a live virtual discussion with Ms. Obama and over 10,000 women who had read her book. Through those conversations, Chapman realized that our community was full of not just readers, but also some writers, and they also wanted an opportunity to become authors. Becoming a writer is one thing. Becoming an author is quite another. The first requires talent, dedication, and, above all, a story to tell. The latter often requires connections and always requires an intimate knowledge of a publishing process that sometimes feels designed to trip up outsiders. That knowledge, Chapman realized, could be taught. She reached out again to Penguin Random House with a proposal for a publishing incubator program. We would allow women from all walks of life to join the cohort and over a 6-week period learn everything they needed to know to demystify publishing, she explained. The publisher agreed to the partnership, and the Women and Words Incubator became a smashing success. Thousands of women completed the program, and a disproportionate number of them also completed manuscripts, signed agents, and secured book deals. Because we saw that this community just has so much quality writing and so many stories to tell, Chapman recalls with a smile. We decided that it was best for us to launch an imprint. Oprah Daily recently sat with Chapman about Storehouse Voices' work to elevate underrepresented voices and her determination to break the mold. The idea and the goal. The imprint grew out of a powerful idea that stories have the ability to transform lives. I had someone tell me recently that everyone has a story, and if you sit down and you talk to someone long enough, everybody probably has a book in them. But the reality is that only a small percentage of us will ever have an opportunity to tell our story. So how do we break through the traditional mode to allow so many more of these stories to be told? on barriers keeping marginalized voices out of mainstream publishing. I think that a lot of it has to do with proximity. I don't think that it is intentional. I think the only thing that's really been missing is access to information, because the moment you have the information, you could go out and you could do the work and you can show up the way that the companies and the agents would want to find you. So our greatest work is just making sure that we're passing on the information and making sure that it's going to all of the right places. What's she doing differently? At every publishing house, there are only so many people that they can publish, and so you have to come up with some sort of process to help you weed through what's there. I think what's different for us is that when we get ready to think about the stories that we want to publish, we'll simply have a different filter. And because we're taking the time to develop the incubator program and run people through it, it gives us an opportunity to have folks show up the way that we would want them to. That makes it easy for us to say yes. And even if we're not in a position to become their publisher, we've taken them much further than where they already started, because now they have the tools that they need to approach other imprints or other publishing houses, or they may also have an opportunity to go out and self-publish. Inspiration. I find sources of inspiration in books, and so for this particular journey, one of the first books I went to read was The Wright Brothers Book. I just always remember hearing, you know, the Wright brothers did not have a background in aviation, but they were the ones that figured out how to get us into the sky. And so I wanted to understand from them what were the characteristics that you needed in order to be able to do something that's never been done before. When we first started having a conversation about storehouse voices and whether or not it made sense for us to launch an imprint, I saw it as an advantage that I'm an outsider. I'm not restricted by what's always been, because I don't know what's possible. I'm just showing up with fresh thinking, and it turns out that thinking is innovative because it's unlike what's ultimately being done today. Advice for women who want to break the mold. Start with purpose, and if the idea solves a problem or it fills a gap, that it'll ultimately resonate, be ready to do the hard work, listen to the community, and build something that really reflects their needs. I would also say don't be afraid to ask for help. It's okay to partner, and for me, that was with Penguin Random House, and leverage their expertise. Collaboration isn't a sign of weakness. It's a sign that you will be able to grow into something that's much stronger. And finally, I would just say believe in your vision. And if it feels scary, then you're probably on to something great. Over in Work and Money, 5 Steps to a Financial Fresh Start. Here's how to live like a king in 2024, whatever that means to you. And this article is by Rosie Hopegood. Personal finance guru Ramit Sethi, and that's S-E-T-H-I, wants you to live a rich life. This may sound a little slick, but he knows a thing or two about the subject. Coming from a middle-class background, he started investing his scholarship money into the stock market while at Stanford. Although he initially lost money, a sharp learning curve led him to start the blog, I Will Teach You to Be Rich, which evolved into a successful money coaching program of the same name. The course inspired a New York Times best-selling book, and Sethi recently starred in the surprisingly bingeable Netflix show How to Get Rich, in which he transforms the money woes of regular families. Think of him as a no-nonsense money Marie Kondo here to clean up your personal finances. But what exactly does he mean by a rich life, and what would it look like to you? Sethi says the answer will be different for everyone. It could be traveling for 2 months a year, could be buying a beautiful cashmere coat, or it could be picking up your kids from school every afternoon, he says. By the age of 40, money is the primary worry for most people, and yet the vast majority have never read a single book about personal finance. Most of us can take control of our money in about 6 weeks. You can get the right accounts, and you can set up your investments to be automatic, and you can even give yourself a very generous amount of money to spend guilt-free every month. But nobody's going to do it for you. Ready to take control? Here's Sati's 5-point plan. Before we start tackling our bank balances, Sati says we need to examine and try to shift our deeply entrenched views about money, many of which took root in childhood. Maybe you feel bad about spending extravagantly, or maybe you worry so much about not having enough that you rarely treat yourself. But money shouldn't be a source of overwhelming guilt. The biggest money script that holds people back is feeling that they have no control over it, says Sati, who helps his clients realize that money is not something that happens to me. I can take control. I can make a debt payoff plan. I can invest. Another common thing he sees is people feeling clueless. Money involves a few new terms, but it's just like learning to drive. You're learning some new terms and skills. It's not that complicated, and anyone can become very good at it. The first step could be as simple as listening to money podcasts at the gym or in your commute. We like Black Girl Finance by Selena Flavius, Financial Feminists by Tori Dunlap, or Sati's own I Will Teach You to Be Rich. Sati believes that overcoming our ingrained money beliefs is essential. Too many people underemphasize money psychology and overestimate math, he says. In reality, you should be spending as much time studying your own money beliefs as you do setting up your investment accounts. Try this exercise. Jot down all your money beliefs that spring into mind and pick the 4 worst offenders. Then make it a 4-week project to flip the script, 1 belief per week. If you need support, you can try the Unblocked Money Manifesting Workshop by 2B Magnetic. Crunch your numbers. According to Sati, there are just 4 key numbers to focus on when you look at your monthly spending. You really do not need to know how much you spent on asparagus last month, he says. This is his breakdown of where your take-home pay should go. Looking closely at past statements will give you a sense of your current breakdown and what you need to adjust. 50 to 60% should go to fixed costs. That includes your mortgage, your rent, car payments, gas, groceries, and any debt repayments. 5 to 10% should go to savings. Sati recommends setting up these payments to automatically transfer into a high-yield savings account. 10% should go into investments. More on this below. The good news is you'll have 20 to 35% left to spend guilt-free. That's a lot of money, right? Says Sati. Once you're hitting your numbers, you don't need to feel bad about eating out or buying something nice for yourself. Treat yourself to what you love. Put your spreadsheets and receipts aside and ask yourself the simple question. What do you enjoy spending money on? Most of us think about money only in terms of restriction, guilt, and feeling overwhelmed, says Sati. He recommends figuring out what you most like to spend on and giving yourself permission to spend extravagantly on that and cut costs mercilessly on what you don't. For example, if fancy fitness classes or monthly facials make you feel happy and energized, don't skimp on them, but cut back in another area. Think of debt like a game you are destined to win, that is. 90% of people who are in debt don't know exactly how much debt they have, and 95% don't know when their debt will be paid off, says Sati. That's what it feels like. That's why it feels like such a burden, because we don't know when it's ever going to end. But there's almost always a light at the end of the tunnel. First things first. Pull your head out of the sand and write down everything you owe, including all the interest rates, credit card balances, your mortgage, student loans, the whole gamut. Next, plug the numbers and the amounts you can pay off each month for each into an online debt repayment calculator. There are plenty of free ones, like this one from Credit Karma. No matter what you plug in, you can see when you will be debt-free, says Sati. You can play around with numbers to see how much more quickly you could be debt-free by paying off just a little extra each month. You'll realize that you have a lot more control than you thought. For example, if you pay an extra $100 a month to your mortgage, you can often shave off years. Be the sheep of Wall Street. Investing is where true wealth is created, says SETI. In I Will Teach You to Be Rich, he highlights that if you were to pay $20 a week into an investment fund, it would most likely be worth $15,672 in a decade. But many of us find investing alarming at best. We've all heard horror stories about a friend who invested in a tech startup after a hot tip from their nephew over Thanksgiving dinner, only to lose their shirt. Rather than doing constant research and investing in individual stocks and shares, SETI recommends choosing a low-cost index fund. For those new to investing, this means a set of investments passively managed, meaning the money isn't moved around frequently, by a professional money manager. You'll pay a small fee to this manager, but make sure it's fixed and not a percentage of your investment. If you pay 1% in fees to a financial advisor, that means that over the course of your lifetime, you'll pay 28% of your lifetime returns in fees, warned SETI. This style of investing is a much safer bet than investing in individual stocks, which can be more volatile, meaning you'll end up with something far more valuable than dollars. Peace of mind. Under culture and news and TV and movies, what does it take to excel under pressure? Ask Gail Simmons. In advance of her 22nd season, The Top Chef Judge shares how the show has changed her perspective on leadership, her advice for standing out in male-dominated fields, and the food trend she hopes never makes a comeback. This article is by Charlie Burlock. When Gail Simmons started judging Top Chef, Pluto was still considered a planet. Taylor Swift had yet to release her first hit single, and MySpace was the number one social networking site on Earth. The world has changed immensely over the Top Chef's nearly 20-year run, and so has the show itself. The prizes and the production have grown, and the genre of food television has exploded. When we started, the only other food competition show on the air was Iron Chef Japan, Simmons told me. We were this little engine that could, and now, you know, we can't really claim that we're tiny anymore. But we're still fierce, and we still work really hard. Today marks the premiere of Top Chef Destination Canada, the show's 22nd season, and a homecoming for the Toronto-born critic and cookbook author. Shooting most of the show in her hometown was a crazy full-circle experience, Simmons told me over Zoom. Moments after dashing to her kitchen to stir a big pot of chili for her children's dinner. Sorry, real life, she said, gesturing to the stovetop. As a professional food judge, people often assume that she is, well, really judgmental about food. They are nervous to invite her to dinner, to cook for her, or even talk about food around her. I am a mom, she explained. My kids are not eating escargot for dinner. I mean, I would like them to, but they're not, and they're stronger willed than I am. All in all, she's not cooking fancy food, nor does she really want to eat it in her off hours. I just eat delicious food, and that can be from the corner deli if it's made with love, she said. Though the food she will be eating and judging on this season of Top Chef certainly won't be coming from the corner deli and may be made with more panic than love, this no-frills approach to food will still inform her taste. She opened up to me about her approach to judging, her tips for bringing Top Chef techniques into your own home kitchen, and her theory as to why bullies rarely come out on top. You've been a judge on Top Chef since the very beginning. How has your approach to judging changed over the past 20 years? I think what I now consider, what we all as a society, really, as a culture, consider great food has changed. Doesn't have to be fine dining. Doesn't have to be fancy and tweezered. It just needs to be authentic and delicious. I think we're now more interested in food that expands and teaches and explores more than a very rigid way of cooking that we might have looked to 20, 30, or 50 years ago. Are there food trends that you've seen on the show that you hope never come back? I mean, the most obvious one has to be the foam trend, molecular gastronomy, that's what we used to call it. We saw it so much for a time. I'm all for innovation. I love that we're able to take flavors that we're familiar with and apply very modern techniques to dishes or ingredients that have been around forever and see them differently. But the question that Tom always asks, and I have also learned to ask, is, does it make it better? Just because it's different, just because it's a trick, does it improve the way we cook? That's not to say that there are no applications of foam that have been amazing. There's the voluptuous foam that adds flavor and nuance and essence of an ingredient. And then there's the spittle. What would you give to home chefs who want to imitate what they're in the Top Chef kitchen? Let's make something very clear. This show is not about home cooks. It's not about taking recipes and then replicating them at home. These are meals that professional chefs are making completely spontaneously, like out of the corner of their brains, because we've asked them to do this totally absurd thing. Often they make a recipe, and when we ask them about it the next day, they barely remember what they made, let alone how to write it down and make it applicable to the home chef. That being said, I'm not a professional chef in a restaurant either, and every season I learn so much about how to improve my home cooking. But it's more about taking flavor combinations, ingredients, tips, tricks, a tool that maybe I haven't seen before, or that they use in a way that I hadn't thought of, rather than repeating full dishes. Is there any general life advice you've picked up from watching contestants in this extreme environment under so much pressure over so many years? You don't have to be the enemy to end up on top. If you look especially at our last several winners, and really almost all winners and finalists in general, they left the competition incredibly close with their fellow competitors. They formed a bond with each other that will last a lifetime due to the exceptional experience of being on the show and how hard it can be. They all showed incredible care for each other, leadership, and kindness, and were so generous to one another when in need of help or emotional support. Ending up on top is not about taking other people down. It's about lifting yourself up and others up with you. And you can lift people up and still beat them and still win. For so long, that sort of macho bullying energy really seemed to rule professional kitchens, especially when you came up the industry, had a reputation for being quite a boys' club. Do you have any advice for women on coming up in male-dominated fields? Find your mentors. Look to people who've done it well. They will all tell you it wasn't easy. They haven't perfected it. There are dark, dark days, but there are great women out there who are really setting extraordinary examples. So many more of them were accessible to me when I was 20 years younger. I was the only woman in both of the kitchens I cooked in professionally, and now you just almost never see that. You're executive producing a new NBC show, Taste, which stars Julie Bowen as a traditional editor at an old-school food magazine, who is forced to work with the trendy young TikTok chef. How do you think social media and food influencers have changed the way that we cook, eat, and think about food? For so long, people thought that to be a part of food culture, you had to be a foodie, and that was high-end. It was elitist. And that has been completely democratized by social media. We are all foodies now, which I think is an amazing thing. Because we all come from our own cultures that have traditions, we all stock our fridges because we need to get through every day. Even if you choose to eat a peanut butter and jelly sandwich every day, you've got an opinion about that peanut butter and jelly sandwich. The world of food is accessible and touches everyone in some way or other. Your upcoming book is called Guesting. There are a ton of books about hosting. What made you interested in the other side of hospitality? I've been thinking about this book for about 2 years. And 2 years ago, we were coming out of this time when gathering was really scary. And ever since, we've seen this epidemic of loneliness, and it's partially to do with the residual trauma of the pandemic. Now we want to be home more, and everyone wants to be on their couch streaming a show and being in their sweatpants. And while I love all those things, I think we've all sort of forgotten that the more we say yes to an invitation, the more connected to our community we'll be. Getting off your couch and going over to friends, even if you're still in the sweats, will just make us happier people and less lonely as a culture. So one of the themes of the book is just that. How do we all show up for each other as a community? There are so many ways to be a guest, and that doesn't mean being a burden on anyone. It could mean going to visit someone when they're sick or bringing something really special that you love home from your travels in bulk so that you can share it with a friend. I just feel like there needs to be a bit of a reset. We're over in Lifestyle and Wellness with the Word of the Week. Catastrophizing, is the sky always falling? This article is by Cassie Hurwitz. Catastrophizing. Do you jump to conclusions? Say your mom texts you, "Call me." Do you immediately assume she was in a car crash? Is a throbbing headache clearly a sign of a brain tumor? A delayed flight, a ruined vacation? These aren't rational thoughts. They're catastrophic thinking. Catastrophizing is a distorted way of thinking, says Olivia Verhulst, LMHC, a psychotherapist in New York City. There's no clear-cut cause for this tendency, but it's linked to anxiety and previous trauma. It's perfectly normal to consider possible outcomes and how they'll affect your future. But instantly expecting the worst leads to heightened anxiety and inaccurate perceptions of reality, Verhulst says. It's also exhausting. Stopping the spiral starts with simply noticing your negative thought patterns. Then you can create distance from a catastrophic thought by saying it in a silly voice, singing it, or pausing and recognizing it as a thought versus a feeling, to help you let it go. Then, if you can, swap it for a more realistic thought. As always, therapy and practicing mindfulness will strengthen your resilience to catastrophic thinking, too. And soon enough, it'll be blue skies ahead. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.